Good morning. I hope you're having a good morning. I'm glad to have you here. We're going to start beginning of an exam review for the first midterm. Then the exam review will be today, Friday, and probably part or all of Monday. And we'll kind of go over what to expect and stuff like that. If you had lab yesterday, we talked about the parts of the exam. If you haven't had it, we will talk also in lab this week. But I want to kind of overview of what's going on. Anyway, this exam will be basically over the first three problem sets. So problem sets 1, 2, and 3. What to think about for next week. And again, this will be next week during lab. So instead of having like a problem set and a quiz, what we'll do is that time will just be devoted towards the midterm. Usually the exams are about 2 hours in length, all right? So instead of again doing the problem set quiz, we'll just do the exam. So when you come next week to lab, not this week, all right, the things to bring will be a calculator and a pencil, and you will need a Scantron next week. Scantrons are available in the bookstore, all right, and there are several different types of Scantrons available. As long as your Scantron has 100 questions total, so like 50 questions on the front side, 50 questions on the back side, you're good to go. There's like a green one and a red one and an essay one, and there's probably a turquoise one or something, I don't know, but as long as your Scantron has 100 questions total, you're good to go with me. And while you're there, I do recommend getting a couple of them because we'll need some upcoming exams and stuff like that too, so it will keep you from having to go back to the bookstore as much, but that's your call, of course. But anyway, so bring a Scantron next week. Calculator, pencil, absolutely. Now, the lab we're doing this week, and those of you in Tuesday's lab, we did it yesterday, and those of you in today's lab and tomorrow's lab will do it, obviously, then. The empirical formula lab will be due next week as well. And then also one thing that I talked about with you in lab yesterday, or I'll talk about with you today or tomorrow, the exam prep worksheet will also be due. And exam preps are something I usually ask for before midterms. They're usually 5-ish questions where the question is given, the answer is provided, and you show your work going from the question to the answer, all right? They are in the companion. They're right after problem set number 3, but because of the printing spaz, which was my fault, by the way, you'll see that the exam prep is on 2 separate pages. So this week in recitation in lab, I will give you a copy of exam prep that you can work on. It's the same as the one in the companion, but it's just 1 page, so you don't have to rip your problem sets apart and stuff like that. If you get stuck on the exam prep, by all means seek help. All right, talk to the tutors, talk to me, talk to your colleagues and stuff. It's nothing that has to be done explicitly. I want you to know how to do those things before the exam, all right? So that's the reason why I ask and why I want you to show your work and stuff like that. Also, one thing I did not mention yesterday in lab, and I totally forgot, is that you will need your safety goggles next week as well. In lab this week, we're going to use flames, but very gently. Next week, we're going to torch them. Sorry, burning. Oh, sorry, I'm under control. Anyway, safety goggles are definitely important, so bring some kind of protection next week as well. Now, the format of the exam, of course, this will be the first time that most of you have had a midterm from me. There will be 20 multiple choice questions, and each of those questions will have 5 possible answers. Only one of the answers will be right. There won't be like 2 answers or something like that, and they'll be over the material that we've seen so far. These questions are basically like, yes, they're right, or no, they're not right, all right? The short answer questions will also follow at the end of the exam, and these I want to show your work, all right? I want to see what you're thinking. These you can get partial credit on if you set up stuff. If you just give me the answer and it's wrong, that won't be worth any points at all. But if you show your work, your steps, and the last step has something wrong, you'll still get a lot of points because I really want to see like how this all works. You'll take the exam next week during your normal lab time, and a week from this Friday, all right, so next week Friday, if all goes well, I will return them to you with a summary sheet. And a summary sheet is just like an overview of how you're doing in the class as of this time. It's a good idea to check out the summary sheet, make sure that the grades I have entered are the grades you actually got, because yes, I do get spacey sometimes. Also, if you're missing a lab, this will be a good reminder and stuff to make sure you're good to go there. In addition to the review we're going to do right now, one thing that's been really helpful in the past is there is a sample midterm in your companion. And just like the sample quizzes, this was an exam I gave a few years ago. And I do encourage you to check it out. If nothing else, you'll have a better idea what the format of the exam will be like. The sample exam in your companion, I think, has 25 multiple choice questions. Your exam will only have 20 multiple choice questions. That would be the only difference, but it will show you then like kind of what to expect. At this point, are there any questions on the format of the exam? When it's going to be, what you need, stuff like that? Yeah, Mark.
The determination of the formula lab, is that going to be due next week on the midterm?
Correct, that's right. So in your case, Margaret, like we'll do this lab tomorrow, okay? And you'll bring it next week Thursday, turn it in at 8 o'clock and stuff, yeah. But you haven't done it yet, so don't worry about it. And even the people yesterday haven't typed it up and stuff like that, so good. We will do a lab afterwards. It's a kind of a fun lab. This is, like I said, when we torch this stuff. Anyway, just to keep it under control. Like, anyway, questions on other questions? That was a good question. Okay. As always, if you have questions, you know how to get a hold of me. Very important. Email me, come see me, whatever and stuff. But without further ado, let's start this review. So this is just going to be like an iClicker exam review. If you have your iClicker, I absolutely encourage you to participate in the questions. I don't care if you get the question right or wrong. I'd love for you to try to get it right. What I'll do is I'll present a question, I'll wait a little bit for you guys to work on it, and then we'll talk about what the actual answer is. But even if you don't have an iClicker, like you don't have to feel left out or anything, all right? I still encourage you to work on the problem and make your guess what the answer is, and then we'll talk about it still after that and stuff. All right, so this is the first question. We've got a piece of metal, all right? And it has a certain mass, and we're placing it in water, all right? I'd like you to try and figure out what the identity of the metal is. And you can probably see by this question that the identity is linked to the density. So see if you can figure this out and stuff. We'll talk about the answer here in a little bit. Thank you. So scientists will use density sometimes to identify certain types of compounds. If you have a table of the densities and stuff that you're looking at, you can correlate what you calculate in the density in the lab, if you will, with what we did. Now in our lab, of course, we just found the density. I didn't ask you to identify it, but it's not a hard extension. Density, as we've talked about, is a relationship between the mass of an object, usually in grams, divided by the volume of object, often in centimeters cubed. But sometimes milliliters are used. How many milliliters in 1 centimeter cube? 1, that's right. They're the same unit, all right? So a milliliter and a centimeter cubed is the same. Hunter decides to record his densities in grams per milliliters, no problem, all right? It's the same type of unit. Usually milliliters are used for liquids and centimeters cubed for solids, but it doesn't really matter. So we have 10.0 centimeters cubed or milliliters, and we plop in this piece of metal, and the volume goes up to 22.3 centimeters cubed. So metals will add to the volume, like most substances. If you take 10 milliliters of Diet Coke and 10 milliliters of Diet Pepsi and you mix them together, the world will not end, as by what marketing sometimes claims. 10 plus 10 will give you 20 milliliters total, all right? And most compounds are that way. So in this problem, we started with 10 centimeters cubed of water. The volume went up to 22.3 centimeters cubed when the metal was added. So 22.3 minus 10 will give you the volume of the metal. And with objects like this, it's sometimes this is the easiest way to find them. So if this is the mass of the metal, you can divide it by the difference between these volumes. And if you do that, you can see right here, 22.3, the final volume, minus 10. That'll be the volume. Mass on the top, density comes out to be 2.70 centimeter, grams per centimeter cubed. And that certainly is closest to aluminum. All right? So as long as your object sinks, which is often with water, then you can use it to find the volume, mass over volume. Any questions on that? The Earth has many different extremes of temperature, all right? Some are very cold and some are very warm. These are three different kinds of temperatures that you'll find on the Earth: 29 degrees Celsius, 45 degrees Fahrenheit, and 256 Kelvin. I'd like you to try and put these in order of increasing temperature. And I will give you one equation here. The Fahrenheit temperature equals 1.8 times the Celsius temperature plus 32. I'm hoping at this point that you know how to go from Celsius to Kelvin. This might be one that helps. See if you can figure this out. We'll talk about it in a little bit. What number is used to convert Celsius to Kelvin or Kelvin to Celsius?
273.15.
Good, well done, 273.15, right on. In the lab, most of the time, and we will do this more in our labs too, we will usually record things in Celsius, but in Kelvin, we can oftentimes use those in calculations. So the 273.15 number is a good one to know slash memorize slash make a tattoo. I mean, remember somehow, don't make a tattoo of it. That would be really even too nerdy for me, and I like Star Wars Pez dispensers. So anyway, you need to know 273.15. We'll use this number a lot. Now, Kelvin temperatures are never negative, but Celsius values can be, all right? So if you want to go from Celsius to Kelvin, because Celsius could be negative, you have to add 273.15 to the Celsius. In this case, it might be easier to go Kelvin back to Celsius because I have up here an expression for Fahrenheit to Celsius. There's many different ways to do this. In my world, you can probably imagine, I would try and convert all of these to Celsius. I can convert Kelvin to Celsius by subtracting 273.15. And I can turn the Fahrenheit value here into Celsius using this equation. Because this number is less than 273, this Celsius value will be a negative number, and that will be lower than 29. So this one's going to be pretty low. Now, if you know about Fahrenheit, and if you don't, it's quite all right, 32 Fahrenheit is the freezing point of water. And what is the Celsius value for the freezing point of water?
Zero.
Zero, all right? So this number is also going to be above zero Celsius. That's going to make this one here the lowest one, all right? So of all of these then, 256 is going to be the lowest temperature on here. It's less than zero Celsius. 45 is greater than 32, so that's what it is. So really what it comes down to then is between C and D, and of course the difference is Celsius first or Kelvin next, or Fahrenheit. And that's where this equation here pops in. So to convert Fahrenheit to Celsius, take the value 45, subtract 32 from it, and then you're essentially going to divide by 1.8. Here's the actual math that I used to do it. First of all, this is the Celsius value of 256 Kelvin. Here is my Celsius Fahrenheit to Celsius conversion. You can see 45 minus 32, then you divide by 1.8, so 7.2. So of all of these temperatures then, 29 Celsius is the highest. It's higher than 7.2 and negative 17. The Kelvin is the smallest one. So answer D looks like a good answer. So again, really, really, really important to know how to go Celsius to Kelvin and Kelvin to Celsius. Fahrenheit, I would give this to you if you needed to do it. And there is value in knowing what KPTV's temperatures are in Celsius, stuff like that. However, most of the time in this class, Celsius to Kelvin is going to be the main thing. Questions? These are distances, and they're distances based on values in the metric system. And so what I'd like you to do is something similar to the last one. I'd like you to put these in increasing size. So start with the smallest one and go to the largest one. And you can see here that there's a milla and a centa. And at this point, I'd really like you to know how to convert milla and centa into regular base units. So see if you can use these numbers and convert them over to something that makes sense.
when I grew up, we never talked about metrics at all. So if you're having problems with this, I completely understand. I do want to also reiterate, though, that this isn't hard to figure out, all right? It's kind of a pain if you're not used to metrics, but once you see it, there's real value in this powers of 10 thing because it's a lot easier to convert. So real quickly, in Chem 221 and all the way to Chem 223, knowing kilo, centa, milla, micro, and nano are really important, all right? Because we'll use these all a lot, all right? Kilo is a lot of times used for kilograms, mass. We'll talk about nanometers in an upcoming section, which is the wavelengths of light. So knowing how all of these relate back to a base unit is important. So in this problem, the base unit is literally the type of thing you're looking at. These are all distances. So I'm going to refer to these things in distances, but they could be grams in mass, they could be times in seconds, et cetera, et cetera. So if the base unit is the meter, then you literally put a meter on both sides of the kilo and the 10 to the third. So what this is saying is that 1 kilometer or kilometer is 10 to the third meters, which is 1,000 meters, all right? And if the power of metrics is that if you're using instead grams, you would say a kilogram is 1,000 10 to the third grams. And someone comes up with a unit of blah, 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 and you have no idea what it is. If they say kilo, blah, 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 then you know that that's 1,000 blah, blah, blah. All right, sorry to be too silly about this, but I want you to see how important it is, right? It's an automatic way to translate things over from one to the other. So, in this problem, we're talking about lengths, meters. So for all of these, a centimeter, 10 to the minus 2 meter. A millimeter, 10 to the minus 3 meter. A micrometer is 10 to the minus 6 meters. And a nanometer is 10 to the minus 9 meters. Now, centimeters, a lot of times what people will do is they'll divide both sides by 10 to the minus 2. And when you do the math, it comes out that there's also 100 centimeters in 1 meter. And that's fine to think about it that way too. All right, either way is cool. So centa is 10 to the minus 2, but a lot of times people will talk about 100 centimeters as 1 meter, or 100 centigrams would be 1 gram, stuff like that. So if you do it this way, you can also talk about this as 1,000 millimeters is 1 meter. It's not as helpful, but you do have then 1,000,000 10 to the 6 micrometers in 1 meter, or you have 1,000,000,000 10 to the 9 nanometers in 1 meter. And either way you want to think about this is cool with me, all right? I'm not invested in the metric system financially, so you know, you can use either one you want. Whichever one works good is cool for you. Questions on how to convert these things? Yes?
I don't know how to convert, but is centigram an actual measurement that's used?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's not as common as like milligrams, all right, and grams and kilograms and stuff, but you could totally do it, and that's the power of this stuff. You could also have the weird like decigrams, or you could have a megagram, all right, of material. It's just some of the fun you can have with metrics, and it shows how scalable it is. Cool question. Will we use it? Knock on wood. I don't think so, Your Honor. Anyway, other questions? Good. So on a problem like this, all right, what I would probably do is convert everything to the base unit. And in this problem, that's going to be the meters, all right? And just looking at the last two values, 2.3 and 0.125, 2.3 is certainly bigger than 0.125. So answer A is out, all right, because 2.3 is not less than 0.125. It's going to be one of these right here. But the next question is what to do with the 215 millimeters and the 9 centimeters, okay? So using whichever system you want to use, and it doesn't matter to me at all, you can convert those to the other two, 215 millimeters and 9 centimeters. You can convert them into meters. And what that means is you want meters on the top and millimeters on the bottom for this one. In terms of the 9 centimeters, you would again went meters on the top, excuse me, but you went centimeters on the bottom. Remember, most of chemistry, something on the top cancels something on the bottom. They go to one, you've got a new unit. So you can use either side you want, it doesn't matter. If I'm using this one, I would have 10 to the minus 3 meters on the top and 1 millimeter on the bottom. On this one, I can use this side just as easily as the other side, no problem. 100 centimeters is in 1 meter. And again, you can flip these around, either one is cool, but again, the punchline here is that you want the old unit to cancel out and you want the new unit left. So, 10 to the minus 3 is like dividing by 1,000. This is going to be 0.215 meters. And 9 divided by 100 will be 0.09 meters. So if you look at these, this one is certainly the smallest one. 0.09 is less than the other ones listed. But 0.215 is bigger than 0.125. So the order then on this one, all right, will be 9 centimeters, 0.09 meters. That's definitely less than 0.125 meters. But because 215 millimeters is 0.215, that would be bigger than 0.125. And then 2.3 would be the biggest of all. Any questions on this? All right. So again, Dylan totally brought it up. It's so scalable, all right? You can use this with so many different things, and they are really useful. It's a lot better than the like 12 inches per foot kind of conversions, because the powers of 12, they just don't gel usually quite as well and stuff. Yeah.
Just a note, for those who have trouble comparing, like squinting at a bunch of decimal values, if you convert it to the smaller thing, you convert it to millimeters, you get a bunch of larger values that are easier to line up. 90, 125, 215.
Good call.
2300.
Good point. Everything I'm saying here really are just suggestions, and that would be another cool way to do it. You could totally convert everything to millimeters and see them a lot easier. You bet. I am a lazy chemist. If I convert to meters, I only have to convert 2, and if you convert to millimeters, you'd have to convert 3. There's nothing wrong with that method, though, and that's awesome, too. So, yeah, no problem. I'm just lazy. I mean, really trying to give you options to prop that back on. Excellent comment. Other questions? Isotopes are a big part of chemistry, like we've talked about. So let's say that we had an element X where Z equals 9. Which one of these is not an isotope of that element? So I want you to think about what a Z number means, and then see what also what an isotope is. And one of those is not an isotope. Up there are the Z values. And what does the blue number like mean? What is it? Number of protons. Well done. That's right. So Z, the atomic number, is the number of protons. So if you look, for example, at lithium there, number 3, that is the number of protons in lithium. Now, the other number on lithium's any entry, the red number, has many names. Molar mass is what I call it most of the time. And that number is an average of all the lithium atoms known. Okay? If I had a big bag of lithium atoms, most of the time I would be pulling out lithium 7, which is an isotope of lithium. Once in a while I would have an isotope of lithium 6, but most of the time it would be lithium 7. So 6.941 is like an average of all these different types of lithium. And the thing that makes the lithiums the same, though, is that atomic number. They all have 3 protons. So an isotope has the same number of protons, which is the lower left number, but the upper left-hand number, which is the mass number, will vary. So like almost all of you saw, which is really cool, this one does not have a 9 down there, so that one, of course, would not be an isotope. All right, these other ones are isotopes. They all have 9 protons, all right? Their mass numbers are different. Those would all be isotopes of the same element. Anything with 9 protons will be fluorine. Fluorine is, you're seeing some of the isotopes of fluorine. What element would this one be? Neon, well done, that's right. Number 10 on the periodic table is neon. So this one would be a neon atom. That is not an isotope of fluorine. It has a different number of protons, different atomic number. Any questions on that? So let's say we had a neutral atom of iron 58. Now 58, after that, I need to think about what it is. Which one of these would be correct for iron 58, or do we have enough information to answer it? See if you can figure out which one of those would be the correct answer. Neutral atom of iron 58. What's the symbol for iron? Fe, all right, yeah, some people sometimes think it's F or IR, but it's Fe, it's number 26 on the periodic table. And again, what does the 26 up there represent? Protons. So of these answers, you've gotta have 26 protons as part of it, because that's what iron is. If you had 32 protons, you'd go on the periodic table over to number 32, that would be germanium, all right? So the answer will certainly not be something with 32 protons, but it could be one of these. Now, if something is neutral, what does that tell us about the number of electrons in this system? Same as number of protons, they're equal. That's right. So if there's 26 protons, there must be 26 electrons, all right? So the last thing then to knock out here, and you can probably just do it automatically, but we need to figure out the number of neutrons. What's the fancy name for this 58 up here?
That's number
Mass number is what I was looking for. That's right. Atomic weights are the averages of, like, up there, the red numbers up there, okay? So the 58 technically is called the mass number, and you don't have to know what the mass number that the name is, but what this represents is it's protons plus neutrons. The mass of an electron is about 1/2000th the mass of protons and neutrons. Very, very small. So in science, when we're worrying about masses a lot, we do worry about the mass, like how much they weigh. So 58 is protons plus neutrons, and we just talked about how iron on the periodic table is number 26. So 58 protons plus neutrons minus 26, the number of protons, you come up then with 32 neutrons. So answer B would be right on, all right, 26 protons, because that's its number on the periodic table. Neutrality means protons and electrons are the same. And neutrons will come from mass number minus number of protons. Any questions on that? Another random element, E. All right, it's got several isotopes that are naturally occurring, and there's their percentages, all right? So element seven, the E72 is about 50%. E73 about 15.6%, and this one's about 30%. Which one of these represents, do you think, a reasonable atomic weight? So now we're going after what Dimitri said earlier. This is going to be something related to the average of these. See if you can figure out what a reasonable atomic weight is. This is a problem you can either do what I called hand waving, talking about it on a number line or whatever, or you can actually do some math to figure it out. Either way, see what you come up with. So we've got these three percentages here. We're trying to figure out what the best value for the atomic weight is. And again, these red numbers have multiple names on the periodic table, but one is the atomic weight. But really, those red numbers are just averages, all right? Averages of all the natural isotopes. So in this example, we have three isotopes. We're trying to figure out a reasonable value. All right. Well, you can probably see that 72 has the highest abundance. What would be a reasonable atomic weight if we had 100% 72E?
72.
About 72, all right? It'd be really, really close to it. And if we had 100% of the 74 isotope, then the reasonable one would probably be a number like 74. If you had 50% 72 and 50% 74, probably it would be about 73. So my hand-waving explanation for this problem is we've got a lot of 72, 50 plus percent, but it's not 100%, all right? There's a pretty good amount of these two right there. So hand-waving, I would guesstimate that B was a reasonable answer, all right? It's close to 72, but it's not exactly 72, stuff like that. Now, some of you, though, like math a lot, which is awesome, by the way, in this class, no problems. You can guesstimate what the value is as well. You can take the decimal version of these percentages, so like 0.545, and multiply it by 72. You'll add that to 0.156 times 73, and you'll add those two to 0.299 times 74. That's a more mathematically based thing. We got to fudge our sig figs a little bit. But if you do that, you'll also come up with a number which is very, very close to 72.8. So this is another type of a way to do these kind of problems, all right? You got to ignore the sig figs on these because they're pretty bad, but you get the idea. You're going to get a math value, but you can also kind of think about it just in terms of statistics. Like you've got a lot of 72, but it's not like 90% 72. You've got pretty good amounts here, so it'll be closer to the right. Any way to think about these is fine. There's no right or wrong answer. Any questions on that? Now, in the earlier example, we looked at a thing that was neutral, and we saw that it had equal numbers of protons and electrons. But a lot of times, as we've talked about now, the atoms are not equal protons and electrons. Some atoms are likely to form, like we know what they are, and some are not likely to form. But if you look at those five ions up there, and again, an ion is just something with a positive or negative charge, one of them is not very likely to form. And I'd like you to try and think which one is not likely to form on that list. Term, I do want you to use one of my versions of the periodic table. You can color a version in if you want. Just don't write like Avogadro's number or nitrate is NO3 minus on that stuff. So, cool. Good question. You can always use periodic tables. Yeah.
What depends on the charges?
Yeah, charges would actually be okay too. So like you could have, which is relevant to this question, you could totally put in the fixed charges and stuff. Yeah, that would be legit. No metric prefixes, all right, I kind of like you. All right, so the periodic table, absolutely important for a lot of these problems, all right? And on the periodic table, there are some ions that we know all the time, and there are some ions that we never know. I call them variable charge ions, all right? But let's review real fast what's going on. The line that kind of goes diagonal is what they call the metalloid line. Things up and to the right are the nonmetals, and things to the left, which is most of the periodic table, those are the metals. And the nonmetals, when it comes to ions, are usually going to be the ones that are negative. So those will be the ones, like fluorine is in group 7, 7 minus 8, negative 1. Oxygen is oxide, negative 2, et cetera, et cetera. None of these are negative, though. These are all metals, okay, which is cool. And there's two types of metals, like we talked about. There are the metals in groups 1A, groups 2A, and then the stairs. And just as a review, the stairs are aluminum, gallium, indium, zinc, cadmium, and silver. And that's why, like, coloring these in on the periodic table is probably pretty smart. These three are positive 3. These are positive 2, positive 1. The other metals out here, we know that they'll be positive, but we don't know what their charge is likely to be. So if you look at all of these, like zinc is one of the stairs, always plus two. Sodium is a group 1A metal, and all the group 1As will always be plus 1, 2. We don't know a lot about iron because it's a variable charge metal, all right? But we at least know it's going to be positive, and it makes sense that it could form, all right? We don't know for sure, but it's not unreasonable. Aluminum is on the stairs, but what's wrong with magnesium? Yeah, it's group 2, that's right. And group 2 is always going to be positive 2, not positive 3. So magnesium plus 3 is a very unlikely ion to form. Now, let's say that Eduardo and I really want to make magnesium plus 3. You can't do it, all right? You can have really high electric fields and stuff. You can strip out an extra electron, but it's very difficult, and it's not something that I could bring to 1303 and say, oh, wow, look at our magnesium plus 3. It would react right away with something and do some crazy things. So in the section we've just gone through, we're talking about the most stable ones, the most likely ones. Magnesium plus 3 would be very unlikely. It would be very difficult to do here like it mounted, for example. Questions? Okay. I'm going to wait, I think, until Friday to do the next questions. We can talk about it a little bit, so we'll stop here. I'll see you guys in lab maybe today or tomorrow. Otherwise, I'll see you on Friday. Have a wonderful day.